Today is known as Black Friday because it's usually the busiest shopping day of the year. Between now and Christmas, nearly everyone will be heading to the stores to buy gifts. As you're making your purchases, you'll probably be wondering if what you've bought is truly well designed and if it's going to withstand wear and tear. Consumerism and design was the subject of Ralph Nader's talk last week at the Philadelphia Museum of Art in conjunction with their show Design Since 1945. Coming up, we're going to hear that talk. Ralph Nader has for years been the key figure in the American consumer movement. Nader now heads the group Public Citizen, which is a network of consumer organizations including Congress Watch, the Public Citizen Health Research Group, Critical Mass, and the Tax Return Research Group. The talk we're going to hear was recorded on November 13th at the museum. Their Design Since 1945 show continues through January 8th. This is Ralph Nader.
I'd like to go through a number of areas that I think are very critical in extending the democratic utility to design efforts so that people can live better lives. The first point is that the designer's profession has to be elevated, and you do that by giving the designer a greater role and a greater responsibility in the production of the product and in the marketing of the product. As long as the stylist or the designer is going to be held up to very low standards, largely as a cosmetic add-on, then we're not going to be able to expect much from industrial designers as they work in the engineering areas, architectural areas, and so forth. I was interested in this a number of years ago when I wrote as a law student to the auto companies asking for information because I was going to do a paper on automobile design and liability. And I wrote, and I could never get much of a reply when I wrote and asked them for their research safety studies. They would always brag about their research and development in their ads, but whenever I would write, I couldn't get anything. All they'd send me were the brochures that their dealers were handing out for the model year car that year. This was in the 50s. So I decided to get specific. So I wrote a letter to all four auto companies saying, what is the function of the fins on your car? You remember the fins in the 50s. And I wrote it to the stylists because that was what was most invested in at the time. The styling people had a lot of facilities and resources, and the safety engineers were off in some cubbyhole, tried it out once in a while to crash a few old cars into walls for the purpose of visiting legislative delegations. And back came the answer was, these fins fulfill an important aerodynamic function. Now, you remember some of these fins? First of all, the 1959 Cadillac, which is pictured in the book designed since 1945 that the museum has put together. The 1959 Cadillac had a three-pronged tail fin, which reminded me of the tail of the dinosaur Tregosaurus, which might have been its inspiration. And that was supposedly important in fulfilling an important aerodynamic function. Well, I put the letters aside, and as the 60s matured, the fins receded. They became smaller and smaller until they disappeared a few years later. And then I said to myself, how was I to believe those stylists who wrote me with that answer, that these fins fulfill an important aerodynamic function? The only way I could continue to believe them was to believe in turn that the winds had changed in the meantime. Now, let me start with the aesthetic impulse. Anybody who works in the consumer advocacy area, sooner or later, has to be very impressed by the power of the aesthetic impulse in all human beings. And we know from archaeologists and anthropologists that this is absolutely cross-cultural. Every culture ever studied, however, quote, simple, or as they use the word, primitive, has a very strong aesthetic manifestations, going right back to the cave dwellers with the paintings on the wall. And there have been many books and studies on the aesthetic impulse, but we still really don't understand its incredible hold over us. And I want to give a rather garish example just to drive the point home. In my discussions with students from time to time, I try to get them to unlimber their imagination and to see whether they thought about these things. I would ask them the following questions. Would you like to be responsible for saving many human lives? And they all sort of say, yes, of course. Very few say no. And then I say, well, if you had the following choice, what would you do? If somebody could say to you, magically, that you could be responsible for saving 100 human lives a year in this world, in return for just one concession by you, and that concession is that your nose would be extended permanently by 3 inches. It would not interfere with its function at all. It would simply be extended by 3 inches. And these students suddenly became very serious because most of them demurred. They didn't want to give up their present nose size. And they began to explain it as the discussion proceeded. They began to explain it that it would totally disrupt their progress in life, and maybe they could save more lives, said one, if became a person interested in preventing epidemics or building safer structures and so on. And in getting down to their specifics, they would say they would be ostracized. They would be looked at with utter disbelief and ridicule. And then I said, well, you know, you have something there, because do you think any of our presidents of our country in the 20th century would ever have become president if they each did everything that they did to become president, except refuse at all times to wear a necktie? Well, I'll leave that hypothetical to you. So deep is the aesthetic impulse that it brings with it, if we're not careful, a tyranny, a social tyranny. It brings with it a conformity that is absolutely super efficient, the most effective conformity structure probably that human beings have ever devised. Doesn't even need to be any police. The enforcers are the people who conform, or some would say the victims do the enforcement for themselves. Now, in about 13 years ago, I was going out to the airport here at Philadelphia, and anybody who goes out to the airport at Philadelphia understands what industrial ugliness can be like. And I was riding in a public transportation vehicle, and a mother and her 9-year-old girl, daughter, were sitting across the aisle. And we were going along, and the youngster saw the refineries, and they were all belching. And the youngster says, Mommy, look at all that pollution. Now, it's really interesting when I heard that, because 10 years earlier, a similar 9-year-old might have said, Mommy, look at all that smoke. And that was an advance in perception, which is something we need to be reminded about when some people say there's been no progress whatsoever in these areas. A professor friend of mine once said that we should have prevented pollution from occurring in this country simply because it's ugly, long before we found out that it was cancerous or harmful. The assumption under that statement is sort of an assumption that harkens back to the comment that in nature, the beauty of a flower or of an animal is very much correlated with some function, some survival mechanism. But we have our own examples here. And the first and most personal type of design is the design of the face by the cosmetic industry. And the design of the face by the cosmetic industry has now become a very rapid turnover process. That is, there are certain current items of facial beauty that are now accepted, and they will be phased out, and new items will come in. As you know, rouge was once in, and then for a number of years it was out, except for people working in circuses, and now it's in again. And years ago, we used to think that women who wore mascara came from South America exclusively, and now it's more widespread. And of course, they're working on men too. Men are now catching up in the cosmetic race. It was only two, three decades ago when male cosmetic firms had to resort to the following types of ads. They would have an ad with a big football player would state across his t-shirt. He was looking at you very grim-like, very tough-like. He had a few teeth out. He had a football hanging on the wall behind him. And the subtitle was, Jack Jones uses so-and-so's cologne. Would anyone care to argue with him? You see how far the ads have come since those days when they had to break down certain taboos. There's really almost nothing left now that men can't buy that women have always able to buy by way of cosmetics, except lipstick. And that apparently is coming in the 90s and will be called something like male glisten. Now, the cosmetics and the general appearance of human beings are very, very important. And the question is, who shapes these aesthetic standards? Years and years ago, they were shaped by individuals who kind of had a more breakthrough sensitivity in the area. The people who painted on the caves, or the people who carved beautiful handicrafts, and so on. But increasingly, it is beginning to be a standard of aesthetics shaped by business and by corporations. They certainly are doing that in the cosmetic area, and from the cosmetic area through to other areas of human appearance. They are beginning to control almost entirely the definition of human beauty. And the definition of human beauty is not a luxurious cosmetic factor to be commented upon and dispensed. The billions of hours which teenagers fritter away in anxiety and neurosis and unhappiness and nervousness because they don't feel that they have met the minimal standard of beauty that their peer group and others expect them to meet. And when these standards are set by Revlon, Helena Rubinstein, and Menins, and so forth, something begins to happen to those individuals who are expected to conform. They lose something of their own identity, something of their own critical capacity, something of their own determination to resist this kind of manipulation, which places ephemeral and very, very temporary standards of aesthetics in terms of human appearance at a level of priority higher than the development of the mind and the development of a more refined sense of aesthetics. You might begin to wonder why this is such a strong impulse and why companies are determined in all areas of design to try to control our taste, shape our taste, shape our sense of what is aesthetic and what is beautiful. Because it fulfills very important commercial functions that have very little to do with aesthetics. If they can get us to look at the automobile basically in a cosmetic manner, they can continually sell us the same automobile every year with minor variations, as long as they change the aesthetic appearance of the automobile. The grill pattern is grinning one year and grimacing the other. The fins are up one year, they're down. There are chrome strips, there are certain decorative colors, etc. In short, our attention begins to be directed toward the packaging of the product rather than what's inside the product, such as a better engine, which is less polluting and more efficient, or cars that will not expose you to death and injury at 50 or 40 mile an hour impacts into abutments or trees, or cars that will not expose you to enormous amounts of silent cumulative violence that we too charitably call pollution. So the aesthetic strategy of businesses is not simply something that can be dispensed with as a surface cosmetic. It goes to the very core of camouflage, of the determination to sell the easy way through the appearance, the color, the shape of a product, rather than to sell the hard way through the function, the safety, the durability, the health, the value of the product in terms of the way it's going to be used. Now, the fact that this aesthetic strategy, Madison Avenue style, has developed to such a level of intricacy and success is a reflection of the enormous imbalance between sellers like the Fortune 500, DuPont and General Motors and Exxon and insurance companies and so on, between the sellers and the final consumers. Because the more successful the corporate style strategy is, the more it tells us that people who buy these products are not being given higher expectation levels by companies or by third parties, such as independent industrial designers. They're not being given higher expectation levels about what kind of quality, safety, durability, etc., they could get when they buy this automobile or when they buy this house. And secondly, it tells us that consumers are not able to get much of this information from their own energy at the beginning. I mean, if they organize later, they can get it. But just in terms of a few days before the sale is going to be made, how do you get this information? It also tells us that there's very little data about how style can do more than camouflage, but it can injure people or expose them to fatal consequences in the use. There are many slides, medical slides, which we went through in the 60s, showing how the outside of cars, with the tail fin, the hood ornaments, the sharp edges over the headlamps, produced much more serious injury to pedestrians struck by these cars, even at speeds as low as 3 miles per hour. And most pedestrians, there are 500,000 a year struck by cars in our country, most pedestrians are struck at very low speeds, indicated by the fact that of the 500,000 struck, about 10,000 are killed. The rest survive. And if you are struck by a flat metal surface, you're likely to be less injured than if you are struck by a protruding sharp point. I mean, that's nothing that requires modern engineering research. Over 2,000 years ago, the Greek physician Hippocrates laid down the rule when he said the human body can tolerate more safely a collision against a plane surface than a sharp cutting edge. Here he was. He gave General Motors over 2,000 years lead time. And the principal progress that we've made on external ornamentation in the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Program was a little bit of bureaucratic pressure, not a requirement, that if they're going to put hood ornaments on your cars, they have to put them on a spring base, so that if you're ever hit by a car, you should remember, do not allow the car to push you up and you come down on the hood ornament. You have to hit the hood ornament flush and it'll bend back. Now, one engineer offered the auto companies a very unique way to test whether their external designs on cars were safe, and that is to take the car just before it's being mass-produced and its final model contours, and to put the chief executive of the company on the outside of the car and just drag him across the front and the back. And if he screams in discomfort, then send the car back to the human factors engineers. There's no reason why we should have these protrusions. Their only real function is to protect vehicles from pedestrians. Now, Now, having described the aesthetic strategy or the design strategy of companies as a mechanism of camouflage, and there's another area where this is very prominent as well, and that is in the supermarket. You go to a, I often wondered what would happen if a Philadelphian, let's say here, who grew up in 1840, were to suddenly come back from the hereafter and join you in a visit to the supermarket, and without being instructed about modern day behavior patterns. And the first thing the 1840 consumer would do is go to a number of shelves with packages and just rip open the package. You see, you know, he wants to see the bread, just tear open the bread and see if it's good. That would get that person in deep trouble, of course. But look at the extraordinary attention to packaging in the supermarket. One type of packaging is to try to get you to think that what is pictured on the cover is really inside. Like the TV dinners. Another type of packaging is to give you the impression that you're getting a deal. That is the big economy size package. And a study by some students at the University of Rhode Island a few years ago showed that in more cases than not, the economy size actually gave you less in terms of value. Pound per dollar type value. And then there are other ways the packaging, light is used as a camouflage, the way light is used at the meat counter to make fat look like filet mignon. And there are other ways that the aesthetic attention. I once went through a breakfast cereal manufacturing plant because I always like to go through factories wherever I am, learn a lot that way. And I went through this breakfast cereal plant in Michigan. And I was amazed. For about 90% of the tour, all the attention was on the package. I mean, just to get that package just right, the rooster, look, you know, so the head doesn't come over the top. I mean, it was all done, very great attention, the graphics all the way. And then at the end, it was like as an afterthought, you know, the end, they put in the cereal, you know, shoot, put in the cereal. And really, the package and the attention to detail is great. So you always ask yourself, if they pay so much attention to design, and you can't eat design, you can't eat that package. If they pay so much attention, why? And what is it that they're putting into that package as an afterthought? Breakfast cereal, much of it with very little nutrition. Some of it now with sugar built into the flake, up to 40% of the weight of the breakfast cereal flake. It's candy. So we are, I think, well on the road to becoming more critical, demanding consumers if we develop our own critical design philosophy, if we develop our own self-generated aesthetic feedback. Now, just to give you an illustration, of the tyranny of this design manipulation. Look at the history of women's clothing fashions over the years. Look at in the Victorian period when they were contained so tightly, their ribs almost would be damaged. They could hardly breathe. Of course, the men drew all kinds of personality consequences from that as well. That's just women behaving. And I mean, the women rarely said to the men, how would you behave if you could hardly breathe and your ribs were about cracking, just to make you look good for us? Well, we thought we were over that with the onset of the women's rights movement and that there would be far more function and comfort to women's clothing. And in fact, when I did a little research on the property damage in the United States produced by the spike heel in the 50s, damage to linoleum, to rugs, it was unbelievable. And the reason why is because the pound per square inch pressure of the spike heel is much greater than that of an elephant's foot. Much, much greater. And women were getting in car crashes because their heel would go right through the floor of linoleum or whatever of the car when they had their foot on the throttle. That can be very uncomfortable when you want to pick your foot up and go to the brake and your shoe doesn't want to go with your foot. And then I spoke with podiatrists who told me that the majority of patients who come in to their offices are women having problems with their feet, and many of those women are having problems because of the shoes that they are expected or expected to buy and wear. And they went into great detail about back problems as well as ankle problems and so on. And that's when I first became very became very respectful of the aesthetic impulse in our society, that people would actually wear shoes that were painful and that increased the risk of tripping and falling, etc. And then when you ask them, why do you wear painful shoes? Some of them say, why, I can't wear flat shoes anymore. That's painful, because they have acculturated their foot to that perch. And of course, nobody can argue that that is a natural way for any human being to walk. In short, they began internalizing their own rationalization for it, although many did admit that it was not comfortable, and they wore it because it was the fashion, or because it was expected of them, or because it looked nice, but it was not comfortable. Well, applying this to other products in our society, just let me illustrate the evolution of car design in terms of safety in the last 15 years. Some of you remember the dash panels in the 50s and the 60s. The various instruments were hooded by protruding metal objects. We call them cookie cutters. They're like cookie cutters, only it wasn't very much like cookie cutters when people's heads hit them in low speed impacts. And something on the order of a 15 mile an hour collision could create a fatal head injury striking that dash panel and those very sharp pointed knobs and the cookie cutters. And when the laws came into effect in 1966, and even a little before that, because there was increasingly critical review by crash research scientists about these protrusions on the dash panel, how was the change executed? It was executed by moving some of the instruments over closer to the driver, so the driver would not be exposed because the steering column would be the interface, and flattening out the dash panel with padding, so that if you did hit the dash panel, as today's cars indicate, you would hit a flat surface, not a sharp metal edge. At the same time, the steering column, which used to go back into the driver in a left front type collision, a main immediate cause of death in motor vehicle accidents, something like 300,000 people have been killed by being impaled from their steering column. Again, you see the design choice. The auto companies knew years ago that a collapsible steering column was possible and very inexpensive. The first collapsible steering column was patented before World War I, and there were several in the 20s patented. But they knew, and the patent basically, which was held by the auto companies, the patent would say, here is a collapsible steering column, and the reason why it's new and deserves a patent is because the old steering columns do not collapse and have a tendency to ram back into the passenger compartment in a collision, so that they knew what the collapsible steering column would do by way of safety. And this was finally put in 1966, so that now if you strike your steering column in a left front collision, it is supposed to collapse 8 inches and thereby diffuse the energy levels which would otherwise be injurious or fatal. There's now talk of an advanced collapsible steering column that works even better, but as long as the Reagan administration is the Reagan administration, it will only be talk and not put into the car. Now, you see, in many ways, that styling change on the dash panel, I think in the judgment of most people, improved the aesthetics of the car, and it also improved the safety of the car. In that sense, the form and the function were indeed one. At the same time that we were looking into the auto design era, lo and behold, a professor at Cornell put out a book on unsafe American bathrooms. And there were all kinds of quips, unsafe at any what. And at the time, but this was a very serious study with all kinds of pictures in the book about how the bathroom is designed with the ornaments and the washing basins and the tubs and the toilets, in a way that really caused a lot of injury. Slips and falls, and if someone did fall, they'd hit against a very sharp protruding edge of the towel hanger and so on. And to go through that book is really a kind of journey of absolute amazement of how the people who designed these products, and knowing that the home is a major area for injury, knowing that there are little children that scurry around the corner and go into the bathroom and slip and slam against some of the parts of the bathroom, knowing all this, nothing new, knowing that people slip and fall in bathtubs, and still designing these items, these artifacts, for maximum injury, if not discomfort. I noticed that in some chain motels, you go into your room and you turn on the faucet. How many of you have had this experience? And you're washing your face, and all of a sudden you hear something go trickle, trickle, trickle on the floor. You look around, so what's going on? And what's happened is the design of the wash basin and the part around it is such that if there's water on it, it starts forming a little rivulet, and using the law of gravity, comes down on your feet. And this is all over America. I have seen that in motels. And the question, I keep asking myself, who designs this stuff? It's like there's a plant near your feet that you know, you want to water. It's kind of a double duty or something. There are other problems with motels. Given what motels go for now, can you imagine how much soap they manage to give you for that $70 room? But again, the structure of modern bathrooms illustrates, again, perhaps more graphically than anything else, the lack of consumer feedback. The lack of consumers saying, what is this nonsense? I have seen, as I'm sure you've seen, a child running recklessly in the home and hitting his or her head against the sharp side of a chair or of a table in the living room or what have you. And that is almost ice pick sharp. And the child hits, the blood starts spilling, the parents rush to the aid, and no one, after the emergency is over, no one asks, why was that chair designed that way? Why was that table designed that way? Nobody asks. It's a given. And there is an enormous ability for people to assume that just because sellers sell a product and manufacturers manufacture it, that they also ascribe to themselves the proper authority for the safety of that product. Or they say, well, if it was unsafe, the government would take it off the market. So we have developed a passivity here, which only in recent years is beginning to diminish. Not in small part because of television consumer reporters. You ever hear of Herb Denenberg? The Denenberg dump? Huh? Is that properly designed, by the way? Television reporters, investigative reporters, congressional hearings, more and more people are getting higher levels of expectation. I get letters now from auto owners complaining of their lemon cars, and I see words like junk, and no wonder the Japanese are beating us, our industry, etc. There's a broader framework. It isn't just, my car just fell apart, what can you do to help? More and more consumers are complaining with a broader framework as to their complaint. They know they're not alone. They know it isn't just their car. They're increasingly wondering how many similar cars of the same model had this this defect. And in that sense, we are seeing an advance. In the supermarket, more people are demanding something other than just a pretty package. They're demanding nutrition. They're beginning to look for unit pricing or code dating, or they're beginning to look at the label. I mean, not as much as we would all like, of course, but certainly I think we probably reached a low point maybe 10 years ago, and things are becoming better from the point of view of a more critical consumer feedback. Yeah, look how long it takes to get over this type of style or design camouflage. The food companies still want us to buy food on the basis of four standards: that it's easy to chew, that it's visually presentable, that it's easy to prepare, and that it is tasty, or at least until it gets past the base of the tongue. It's tasty. And if we react to those four, we will not be looking very hard for nutritious food, safe food, sanitary food, food that's competitively priced. And that is, that seems to me is the kind of choice that we face. If we go in with our own critical mindset in buying compared to the corporate Madison Avenue appeal structure. And that is not just a matter of getting better value for one's consumer dollar, it's also feeding back a higher value economy. It's in aggregate, if consumers are more alert to these maneuvers by sellers, they will, in the aggregate, weed out the shoddy and the wasteful and the harmful, and reward the higher products, higher quality products, which are also in many ways less expensive, not only because they don't wear out as fast, but they don't have such a bad effect on the environment, which then has to be cleaned up by the taxpayer, or which claims its victims in the hospital. The important thing about all this, I think, is that it comes down to the same old advisory, which is that design can be something that reflects the needs of human beings, or it can be something that reflects the manipulative tactics of less than scrupulous sellers. And so it is not a neutral factor at all. It's not simply something that's linear. We have so much sensible design now, let's double the amount later. It's something that is constant flux and dynamics and can be used for very serious harm to people as well as to manipulate them in terms of value not received. If we look at the frontiers of design here, we are seeing some very exciting developments, especially in the area of aid to the handicapped or to disabled people. Increasingly, people with visual impairments, hearing impairments, mobility impairments are going to be able to live much more comforting, secure, and happy lives. They will no longer wonder whether, if they have an emergency, anybody will know about it. They'll be able to use the telephone. They'll be able to turn on the television set if they cannot hear and see what is going on, not only with sign language, but in other much more electronically gadgety ways that are coming to the marketplace. Furthermore, there is an extension of the industrial design momentum to fulfilling the needs of underdeveloped societies, people who really need to conserve, who really need to turn pig manure into fuel, who really need to have small-scale solar cooking units, who need to have a way to measure whether their village drinking water is contaminated or whether it's adequate for consumption, who need to be able to store their materials. And this is an enormously exciting area in its conception and less exciting in its implementation. That is, there are far more practical artifacts developed for people at the margin of scarcity, the billions of people who live at the margin of scarcity and deprivation. Far more artifacts developed in the area known as appropriate technology than there are now being used. Although visitors to India recently have indicated that there is a considerable dissemination of some of these products throughout thousands and thousands of villages in that country. But we're also now seeing a development of design for business computers and office computers. Some of you who use office computers may ask yourself, is this computer designed to relate to you, to your needs? Is it going to induce fatigue? Is it going to induce inefficiency? Is it going to expose you to something you shouldn't be exposed to? Is the color of the computer screen right? The green, use of the green, is that the best color? Well, these are now being asked, as millions of these computers are being produced, the human factor's command over the design is in a catch-up stage. It is not coming parallel with the production stage. It's now in a catch-up stage. There will be people who have to complain of all kinds of occupational discomforts in using these machines before they go back to the drawing boards and apply what is already known to the design of their computer. I know those of you who've used typewriters, haven't you seen the difference in the design of the keys? Some keys you can use and reach an efficiency of words per minute that you think you measure up to, and others are very difficult to use. Some people have great difficulty using certain design keys that other people don't. You see, extending that a little bit, over 70 years ago, a fellow named Dvorak, D-V-O-R-A-K, designed the keyboard for the typewriter in a way that could increase your typing speed by at least 35% to 40%. You know, the keyboard now, you can see it when you're typing, the letters are not just an alphabet. You don't go A, B, C, D. They are designed in a way, presumably, to increase your efficiency. Well, Dvorak said that this was a design that was developed in the late 19th century. It was a poor design, and it reduced the efficiency, speed, and accuracy of typing. So he designed his own. And then he could never get it accepted. He died about 8 years ago. There's a whole Dvorak society now in England and the United States trying to get it at least put on some of the word processors. The Army in World War II looked at it and came very close to trying to adapt it, but they didn't. And if you ever use a Dvorak keyboard, it doesn't take you very long to learn how to use it if you know how to type and to see that you can type much faster. Now, why the opposition? Why the opposition to this? One argument was that just retraining is a kind of hurdle, and nobody wants to engage in retraining millions of people who are typing, even if it's just a matter of a few days. A second argument is, I think, more interesting, and that is that the typewriter companies would sell fewer typewriters. If people were, you know, you would have a higher efficiency coming out of 10 typewriters, Dvorak style, than you would, say, 14 typewriters, current style. Well, this is, again, an illustration of how often we can use a machine and never question the way the keyboard is. We just take it as a given. We can spend thousands of hours on that machine. We never say, I wonder why the W is there instead of here. And that, again, is an illustration of the passivity, of the surrender of consumer-driven critical capacity to question these products. You know these bicycles for kids where the handles are way up? There's an illustration for you. You see, ever see a seven-year-old kid hardly get up on the handles? And that is not a very safe way to design the handles as well. So in conclusion, I think the whole horizon of design, product design, industrial design, design for disabled people, needs, the design for and underdeveloped society needs, the design for medical equipment, as well as the more conventional design for consumers and plant design, all of these open up most of the issues that we talk about in the consumer movement. That is, coming from the design approach, you can raise the issues of safety and of health and of design tyranny and of waste and of efficiency. Most of the issues can be developed that way. And you say, well, why is that important? If you can come at it from another way, why come at it through the design avenue? It's important first because it's more interesting. It just is more interesting if you can discuss an issue of gravity from a doorway that starts with aesthetics and design. The second is, it's more comprehensive. Looking at design questions requires you to continually interrelate and network the whole framework of the project, like an automobile, or like the design of a hospital, or of a school. And thirdly, coming at it from the design point of view gives people a sense that they can affect the situation, that they can reject these designs, that they can develop their own standards before the crisis erupts and Congress has a hearing and you have mandatory standards, as we very often must have. But that is, in the private sector, these kinds of expectation levels, these kinds of demands can be made. So it gives people something they can do, not just as citizens, to improve consumer well-being through the design route, but something they can do as individuals in rejecting the design manipulation that is foisted on so many people by corporate strategists and tacticians. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Ralph Nader speaking on consumerism and design at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Ralph Nader's speech was presented in conjunction with the museum's show Design Since 1945, which runs through January 8th. After his speech, Ralph Nader took questions from the floor. The first audience member asked whether there were consumer movements in other countries.
Unfortunately, the consumer movement in this country is probably stronger than in most other countries, even though it needs to be a lot more dynamic. In Japan, they can't go to the courts the way we can on product liability or product defect or lemon automobiles the way we can. The parliament does not have a tradition of investigating consumer abuse the way our Congress does. And so their approach is more to try to initiate consumer boycotts. There is a group called the Housewife Association, which has several million members, and through a very powerful boycott against Matsushita Electric some years ago, because they caught that company selling TV sets cheaper to Americans than they were selling them to Japanese. Enough of that. So that's the kind of approach it takes. Plus, of course, the scattering of consumer groups which put out reports. In East Asia, there is an upsurge in consumer interest because in many authoritarian countries, the only permissible way of dissent from an economic point of view is the consumer approach. You can't dissent against the government, but you can dissent against, say, Nestle, which is pushing infant formula on mothers in a deceptive way. And so that is developing in East Asia. Malaysia, for example, consumer groups are working with fishermen to deal with the common interest they have in contaminated fish from industries upstream. So there is some of that, but unfortunately, I think it will await the development of satellite communications for the consumer factor to be more broadly part of citizen movements.
The next listener asked about new trends in consumerism.
More and more people are looking and participating into group buying. There are now homeowners up and down the East Coast who are group buying their fuel oil. There are elderly people who are group buying their insurance policy. And if once you get to second, third generation levels of group buying, you're going to be able to see large numbers of consumers going to manufacturers and saying, we want to buy the following at the following specifications. Just the way GM, when it goes to its suppliers, it doesn't just go to a showroom and pick between 10 suppliers for its parts that they use in the car. It goes to the suppliers and says, we're a big buyer, and you better believe it. And here are our specifications. We want to buy the product with the following standards and specifications. Now, someday, maybe in the next 10 years, we will begin to see consumers being able to do that. Not in all areas, because some, like housing, will take a longer time if we're dealing with prefabricated housing. It'll take a longer time. But in areas like insurance policies and cars, there's no reason why that can't be done. The car companies are telling us every day with their new computerized systems, they can tailor the car to your need. That is, if you want 15 options, the printout goes back to Flint, Michigan, and they put out the car with those options. Now, that's one step removed from doing it in a big way, and basically saying we have 300,000 buyers and we want a four-door sedan and we want it at a cheaper price and we want automatic crash protection and we want this and we want that, and, you know, what's your bid?
The next question to Ralph Nader was about products that were banned in this country and then shipped overseas.
Pesticides banned in this country because they're too dangerous to be used as determined by, say, the EPA. But they are not banned from being exported. So chemical company A exports domestically banned pesticide B to Central America or to Ecuador, and this pesticide is used on banana crops, and the bananas come back to this country contaminated with the pesticide. Or the coffee. That's one cycle of poison, as they're calling it. And then we found that the chemical companies were applying to children's pajamas a few years ago, Tris, a chemical Tris, for fire retardant, The government did not require them to use Triss. They just required them to have fire-retardant pajamas. They could have used a safer chemical. They used Triss. Triss turns out to be cancer-causing. And all these millions of kids were using these pajamas. And then the ban went into effect. What did the companies do? They shipped them abroad, the inventory. Shipped them to Asia, Africa, South America. Now, the Carter administration was moving toward controlling this. They issued an executive order in 1980 requiring the government to alert foreign governments to this kind of trafficking and trade. The same occurs, by the way, with pharmaceutical products that are banned in this country, is sold abroad, or chloramycetin, which is allowed to be sold abroad without any contraindication labeling. In this country, it does, because it can lead to a very fatal disease among children. Anyhow, the Carter administration was moving in that direction. One, the alert function, and two, to hold up these products. In other words, they're moving toward perhaps prescribing them. And the first anti-consumer act that the Reagan administration took when they got into office was to revoke the Carter executive order, to say that who are we setting ourselves up as the global nannies? Other countries are perfectly capable of deciding what they want to consume, and there are going to be no controls and no alerts on the export of domestically banned products.
Finally, an audience member asked Ralph Nader what he thought the implications were of planned obsolescence on product design.
Planned obsolescence is the antithesis to a good design environment, because if the company is just selling you something disposable or selling you a car that wants you to sell in 2 or 3 years, are they going to really put a broad philosophy of design into that product? That's one of the reasons why the standards are so demeaning in many product areas, and that's why a lot of people are going back to old products. They want to buy old chairs. That's the antique business is booming, and it's not just 100 years antique. People are going back to the day when products were designed because they were believed to be lasting for 20, 50 years or a lifetime. And when you have to sell a product that is going to last for the duration, you're going to be designing in that way. Thank you.
Ralph Nader speaking at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on November 13th in conjunction with their show Design Since 1945. This exhibit continues through January 8th. Nader's talk was recorded for 91 FM by Amy Taubin.